Good afternoon, guys. Wait a couple minutes and we'll get started. I'm gonna send y'all the, I actually just kept adding to the doc that I showed yesterday, but I've added some to this. So if you wanna use this. Hey guys, I'll be right back. I got to do something real quick and I'll be back in like a minute. While I'm thinking about it, did either of y'all get your ticket emailed to you yet? I don't know what time they're supposed to be sending them, but y'all should be getting your test tickets today. Have any of y'all seen your test tickets in your emails? Nabil, you got yours. David, Freya, have y'all seen y'all's test tickets? Have y'all gotten them in your email yet? Correct me if I'm wrong, but is the test ticket, it just has your AP ID and then it has like the time and the date and stuff of the test. I think that's all it's on there. You'll just need that to log into the test. So make sure you, at least have your ID. Joy, I was just telling them, have you gotten your AP test ticket emailed to you yet? You should have gotten.
I haven't checked. I'll check now.
Yeah, check. I mean, just make sure. I mean, if something's wrong, you can always go into your AP account and look it up, like your AP ID. But don't forget, while I'm thinking about it, if you didn't do it yesterday, today, tomorrow, whatever you're going to write or type on, remember at the top of your sheets, all your sheets for like your writing, you need to write up in the margin at the top, the kind of the header, write your AP ID and then put your initials. Do that for all of your sheets. So I would go ahead and do that like today or tomorrow. If you're going to write your paper on Google Docs or Word document, go ahead and make a file. And in each of the pages, go ahead and make a few pages. And then at the top of each page, make sure you've typed your AP ID number and put your initials. Okay. That's something they ask you to do. Are any of y'all planning on writing the test like by hand? The only reason I'm saying that is because I think if you're comfortable typing and you think you can finish it fast enough typing, I would recommend doing that unless you just like you don't have access to a computer or something, because there's a couple things with the handwriting is, if your pictures happen to be kind of blurry and they can't read stuff, that could be a problem. Also, there's been some issues apparently with like uploading pictures. Like you have to make sure it's like a certain file. I'll send you guys information about that. But are any of y'all planning on doing writing and taking pictures? Like I said, if you have a computer, I would recommend probably just doing it on there. It's the easiest way. It'll be the fastest way to do it. That's kind of my recommendation. What I might do is, you can do it on Google Docs or Word, but it really doesn't matter. So I'll be right back, guys, and we'll get started. I'm going to go ahead and, here, I'll share this with you one more time if you didn't get this. This is the, hold on, actually. One second. There's the Google Doc link again. All right, I'll be right back and then we'll get started, okay? All right, guys, I'm going to go ahead and get started. Let me share my screen, then we'll get going. Do anybody have any questions or anything before I jump into this? All right, I think most of y'all were here yesterday, or several of y'all were when we did. Yesterday, we talked about the Progressive Era and how the U.S. started to become an imperial power in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Today, what I want to do is talk about the First World War, and then we will also talk about the Roaring Twenties some. So that'll kind of be our focus today, is World War One, the Roaring Twenties. I may start talking about the Great Depression, just talk about some of the causes and kind of effects real quick. And then tomorrow we'll kind of wrap up and I'll talk about the New Deal, FDR's New Deal programs, and then the Second World War, okay? So again, just to please, you know, we're down to the last couple of days. You have today, tomorrow, basically to review. I guess you could review, some of you will probably be reviewing Friday morning. Remember, on the blog, you know, I would definitely try to use the blog is kind of a major resource for studying. Remember on my website, And again, I know I'm driving this, keep doing this, and all y'all, most of y'all that are here already seen this, please use the review resources page. Make sure you know the DBQ. You know, you need to understand how the DBQ is being graded. Get a point for a thesis. You can get a point for contextualization. You can get 2 points if you describe and use 2 documents to support your argument. You can get 3 points if you use 4. I would personally not try to use 4 documents. This is the time constraints can be too tough. And it's only 1 point anyway. So, you know, the difference between using 2 documents and 4 is only 1 point. I don't think it's worth it. You can get 2 points for using, you know, outside evidence. So 1 point if you use 1 piece of outside evidence, 2 if you use 2. And then, you know, the sourcing points are, you know, if you can basically analyze the point of view, the purpose, the intended audience, the historical situation of one document, you get 1. You do it for 2 documents, you get 2. I think you should try to shoot for that. If you're only going to use like 2 or 3 documents anyway, I think you'll have time to describe the document, you know, source it, you know, talk about the point of view, the purpose, the intended audience or historical situation, and, you know, obviously you incorporate it into your argument. So I would not worry about the complexity point. I think like even in normal years, it's very tough to get. And I don't think it's worth it. I mean, you may get it without even realizing you get it. It happens. But I think what I would focus on, get the 2 points by using 2 pieces of outside information, get 2 points for sourcing 2 documents, you know, doing the HIPPO stuff, get 2 points for describing and, you know, using 2 documents to support your argument, and then get the thesis point. And if you have time, maybe go back and add some historical context before your thesis. But other than that, that's kind of would be my approach. And I think if you do those things, you'll get like a 4, possibly a, could be a 5, who knows. But I think equivalent to what would be a 4 on a regular year, all right? All right, let's go ahead and jump in. And at the end, if we have any questions, I'll kind of open that up. So we'll start by talking about the First World War. Make sure I'm in the right place. Yeah. All right, so by the way, World War One, you know, is going to last from 1914 to 1918. I'm going to add this here just so we're clear about that. So you do want to know when the First World War breaks out in 1914. You may remember a little. You don't really have to know a lot about why the war started. Remember, a lot of it has to do with kind of these European rivalries during this period between countries like Germany, England, France, Austria, Hungary. Remember, in 1914, the war breaks out. Archduke Franz Ferdinand, who was the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, he's assassinated, and this sets off kind of this chain of events that leads to the war. Remember, for our purposes, you want to know the U.S., when the war breaks out, will adopt an official policy of neutrality. All right, we make it clear up front that we are not interested in being involved in the war. You know, the U.S. is trying to maintain this isolationist policy. All we want to do is trade with these countries. We don't want to get pulled into this conflict. And you do want to know the president during the First World War is Woodrow Wilson, who, remember, was elected in 1912. He defeated President Taft, who was running for re-election. He also defeated Teddy Roosevelt, who returned to politics and ran as a third-party candidate in 1912 for the new Progressive Party. But you want to know, Wilson's a Democrat. He's elected in 1912. And he will urge Americans to stay neutral during this time period. Obviously, Americans tend to, you know, most of the American sympathies are going to be with the British and the French, the Allied powers in this war, because, you know, most Americans kind of trace their heritage back to the British. But there are, you know, there are German Americans, you know, the Austrian Americans who are more sympathetic to the Central powers. So, Wilson says, basically, we need to stay out of the war. We need to put America first. We don't need to get tied up in this conflict. Ultimately, you know, the U.S. stays out of the war the first few years. We'll ultimately join the war in 1917. You need to make sure you understand why we enter the war, all right? And really, it comes down to a couple things, and it really has to do with Germany. Germany is the one that really kind of pokes and prods us until we officially join the war. You do want to know, in 1915, Germany will sink a British passenger ship called the Lusitania, which was sailing off the coast of Ireland. If you remember, one of Germany's strategies during World War I was basically to set up a blockade around Great Britain to kind of cut them off from supplies. And they mainly use submarines to do this, U-boats. They would basically sink any type of ship that came into like the vicinity of the British Isles. Didn't matter if it was a passenger ship, a merchant ship. Didn't matter if it was the ship of a neutral country that wasn't involved in the war. The Germans made it clear that these ships, if they came near Britain, they would be fair game. And remember, this strategy was referred to as unrestricted submarine warfare. Again, there's no restrictions on who they'll attack, right? You do want to know that one of the first big ships that sunk because of this is the Lusitania, British passenger ship. 128 Americans are killed, and a lot of Americans wanted to go to war in 1915. But if you remember, Germany actually kind of agrees to back off a little bit. They say, all right, we won't do this unrestricted submarine warfare anymore. We'll give ships fair warning before we torpedo them. 2 years later, 1917, they crank back up unrestricted submarine warfare. You know, this is getting toward the latter part of the war. They're getting kind of desperate, and the Germans will renew the strategy of unrestricted submarine warfare. A lot of American merchant ships are going to be destroyed, a lot of American passenger ships. So this is one of the big reasons we enter the war is because Germany is using submarines to sink ships, and we are kind of getting caught in the crossfire, all right? The other big thing you want to know about is the Zimmermann Telegram. That's in 1917 as well, same time that Germany is renewing this unrestricted submarine warfare policy. Germany essentially sends a telegram to Mexico. It's in an attempt to recruit them on their side. And what Germany basically, they offer this kind of proposal to Mexico, where they say, hey, if you guys will invade the U.S. and kind of distract them, then when we win the war, this is what Germany's saying, then we'll return all that land to you that the U.S. took back in the 1840s in the Mexican-American War. Mexico does not bite. They don't go for this. But we find out about this. And the realization that Germany's trying to recruit Mexico, coupled with the fact that Germany is, you know, sinking our ships, even though we're a neutral country with their submarines, these two things, unrestricted submarine warfare and the Zimmermann Telegram, will eventually pulled the U.S. into the war. In April 1917, we will declare war on Germany. We'll obviously join on the Allied side of World War I. We'll side with Britain and France, Russia. So we're latecomers to the war. We try to stay neutral, but Germany's kind of actions eventually pull us into the war, okay? You do want to know about, you don't really have to know any battles for World War I. Nothing as far as like military stuff. But I would know about the American home front during the war. In 1917, Congress will pass the Selective Service Act, which is basically a draft. This was actually the first time the U.S. had instituted a draft before. We actually, you know, were directly involved in the war. We had just declared war when they did this. President Wilson will also establish the War Industries Board. This is kind of a new thing we'll see in the 1900s. These large-scale global wars in this kind of industrial world that they live in the early, you know, by this point in the 1900s, we've gone through the Industrial Revolution. We'll see that entire economies have to be kind of mobilized to fight a war. And the War Industries Board is basically just a government agency that kind of coordinates the U.S. economy and makes sure that, you know, factories are producing the war materials that we need to be produced. Like they determine what factories make, how much they make. They make sure factories are getting the materials they need to make this stuff. That's basically the War Industries Board basically runs the economy to a large degree during the war to make sure that we have what we need for the war. Okay. You do some other trends that are happening on the home front inside the U.S. during the war. Know about the Great Migration. Remember, that's a lot of jobs are opening up in northern cities during the war because so many people are going off to fight in the war. And hundreds of thousands of African Americans will migrate to northern cities, you know, like New York, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, to basically take advantage of these vacant industrial jobs and also to get out of the South because, if you remember, not much has changed for African Americans in the South since the Civil War. You know, technically they're free, but Jim Crow laws are in place in the South. African Americans are denied a lot of the rights they should have. So you do want to know about the Great Migration. This is this mass exodus of African Americans out of the rural South, and they're moving to northern cities to take, you know, fill these job openings that are, you know, available during the war. Okay. Definitely want to know about the two laws passed during the First World War II, the Espionage and Sedition Acts. Again, espionage just means like spying. Sedition, that term just means any kind of speech that's like harmful to the government. And basically what the Espionage and Sedition Acts do is they establish like fines and jail time, like these penalties, if you obstruct the draft, if you publicly oppose the war, like you speak out against the war, you criticize the government for getting us involved in the war. If you did any of this stuff, you could be jailed and fined. You could be jailed for up to 10 years. Basically, it's silencing free speech to a large degree. Basically, any kind of speech or writing that's opposed to the war, critical of the war, and our involvement was, you know, could be prosecuted under this law. Famously, you do want to know the labor union leader, Eugene Debs, who was a socialist and was one of the kind of leading members of the American Socialist Party. He actually was sentenced to 10 years in jail for giving a speech that was critical of the war and our involvement in it. He was talking about how the war essentially was, you know, like a labor union leader would say, he said the war is basically a capitalist war. Like it's for these wealthy businessmen are the ones that want us to get involved in the war because they can make a lot of money off of it. But it's the poor people who are being sent to fight and die in the war. So Debs gives this speech critical of the war. He's jailed for 10 years because they said he violated this the Sedition Act. Okay. There's another case that involved with this where there's a man named Charles Schenck who was sending out leaflets in the mail, like pamphlets to people, basically men, young men, telling them to dodge the draft, avoid it. And, you know, the court said he was in violation of the Espionage and Sedition Act because he was interfering with the draft. He eventually appealed, you know, this this decision, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. This is a famous Supreme Court decision. It's called, the case is called Schenck versus U.S. And basically what you want to know is the Supreme Court eventually said it upheld the conviction. It said basically, nope, sorry, Charles Schenck, you are not allowed to send out these pamphlets, like because it essentially you are violating the Espionage and Sedition Act. And what they said is basically the Espionage and Sedition Act is not a violation of the First Amendment because you know, certain speech creates like a danger for the country, especially in wartime. So basically, what the Supreme Court said in Schenck versus the U.S. is that the Espionage and Sedition Acts are constitutional. That, you know, any kind of speech that creates a danger for the country is not protected under the First Amendment. And they argued that, you know, speech critical of the war or encouraging dissent was dangerous to the nation. So therefore, it was not protected under the First Amendment. Okay. Again, this is not new, but a kind of trend to keep an eye on is that, remember, during wartime, like times of emergency crisis, a lot of times the government will limit civil liberties. There's a couple examples I can think of, like back in the late 1700s when John Adams was president, you know, England and France were at war. We were kind of getting caught in the middle of it. We were kind of being pulled both ways. John Adams passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, which also basically limited free speech, basically any kind of speech critical of the Federalist Party and they're kind of running the government. The Civil War, remember, Lincoln will suspend the right of habeas corpus during the war, basically so he could jail Confederate supporters who were causing problems in the Union. Again, that was limiting basically a constitutional right, habeas corpus. World War I, we get the Espionage Sedition Acts. World War II, a good example would be Japanese Americans are rounded up and forced to live in internment camps. That's clearly a violation of their civil liberties, especially when there was no evidence to show they were helping the Japanese. So kind of a overarching theme, do remember that during times of crisis, war, the government will use this kind of state of emergency to justify limiting kind of rights if they feel like it's in the benefit of the whole country, okay? You also want to know on the home front around this time, we get the first Red Scare. Remember, the Red Scare is essentially a fear of communism and a communist revolution in the U.S., a lot of the reason this happens is because in 1917, around the time we're entering World War I, Russia actually leaves the war. And the reason they leave is because they are in the middle of a communist revolution. And eventually, the Bolsheviks or the Communist Party in Russia will establish a communist government in Russia, and Russia will be called the Soviet Union. And a lot of Americans are afraid that something similar could happen in the U.S. And remember, we'll talk more about this in a second, but the Americans start to associate ideas of communism and socialism with immigrants who are coming in from like Eastern and Southern Europe. And there's a fear that immigrants are going to bring in these radical ideas and kind of undermine the American way of life. Okay. So definitely know kind of toward the end of World War I and right after, we go through this period of kind of communist fear of communism called the First Red Scare. Women play a major role in the workforce during World War I. They fill a lot of jobs that were traditionally done by men. You also want to know that this is actually going to help them kind of make a case for suffrage. This will kind of build support for that, this idea that, you know, women are playing this critical role in the workforce. They're kind of, their role is starting to change in society. So suffrage is kind of the next step. And we'll talk about that. I say women will get the right to vote in 1920. So ultimately the war ends in 1918. We're pretty latecomers. We're late to the war. Remember our president at the time, Woodrow Wilson, he will actually come up with this proposal for peace after the war, kind of a plan that he comes up with for suggestions for how we can avoid a future war like this one. And this plan becomes known as the 14 points plan, or the 14 points. Some of the things that Wilson suggested, he said, like, if we do this, we can avoid another catastrophic war. He said we should have freedom of seas. Again, that makes sense. He's basically saying countries should be able to trade freely, not have to worry about their ships being sunk. That's obviously a reference to the fact that Germany was sinking neutral ships because of their unrestricted submarine warfare policy. He also said, you know, we should not have these secret treaties, like any kind of treaty should be out in the open for everyone to see. That was one of the things that led to the war, these entangling alliances. He advocated demilitarization, basically like reducing these large militaries that, you know, countries have been building up in the lead up to the war. He also said basically groups of people should be able to decide for themselves, you know, if they want their own independent nation, who's going to govern them. And this is called self-determination. If you remember in the lead up to the war, like the Bosnian people were actually a lot of ethnic groups were under the control of Austria-Hungary. And a lot of these ethnic groups wanted to be independent. So Wilson's saying one way we can kind of avoid wars, allow these different cultural groups to kind of have their own independent nations if they so desire. Okay. And then lastly, and most importantly, you want to know his 14th point in this plan was he suggested that these countries create what's called a League of Nations, like an international peacekeeping organization, where basically if there was a conflict, countries could come to the table, negotiate, and the idea was to avoid war, essentially. Okay. Ultimately, the treaty that ends the war is called the Treaty of Versailles. It's signed in 1919. Most of the peace proceedings, all of them, are controlled by this group called the Big Four, which are the leaders of France, Britain, Italy, and the U.S. Germany, who lost the war, is basically kept out of peace negotiations. They basically have no say in what happens. And ultimately, what happens to Germany is they are basically really harshly punished by the war. And basically, all they can do is accept these, you know, these kind of these punishments because they have no say in the peace treaty. By the way, most of Woodrow Wilson's 14-point like suggestions are ignored in the Treaty of Versailles. Okay, you do want to know though, Germany, like I said, is harshly punished by the treaty. Britain and France kind of see this as an opportunity to really kind of crush Germany, make them pay for the war. Some of the things that happened to Germany because of the Treaty of Versailles is Germany had to accept full responsibility for the war. That's called the War Guilt Clause. Germany had basically reduced its military to 100,000 men. Germany lost most of its overseas colonies, and they lost a lot of territory in Europe. And probably the worst thing of all, Germany had to pay upwards of like $33 billion in reparations to the Allied powers. And this, you know, this really cripples the German economy. And we talked about ultimately these things, like the fact that Germany's humiliated by the Treaty of Versailles. They take away their military, strip them of territory, make them pay all this money. This is going to essentially create an environment that will eventually lead to the rise of the Nazi Party and to Hitler. Because Hitler's going to come along and say, hey, the Treaty of Versailles is BS. Like, if you follow me, we're going to tear this thing up. We're going to build back up our military. We're not going to pay these reparations. We're going to basically get back this territory lost and more. So really, in a lot of ways, the Treaty of Versailles and really the way it handles Germany is really going to kind of set us up for the Second World War, which is going to happen, you know, in about 20 years after this. So you do want to know, ultimately, very important for us as U.S. history students, is the treaty did establish a League of Nations like Woodrow Wilson wanted. That's really the only part of his plan that got actually put into the treaty. Ironically, though, the reason the U.S. Does not sign the Treaty of Versailles, the reason we don't sign it is because a lot of Americans don't want to join the League of Nations. Even though it was our president's idea, there is this kind of fear among Americans that if we join the League of Nations, we will get pulled into more of these European fights that we don't want to be involved in, essentially. So the U.S. basically refuses to sign the Treaty of Versailles, because if you sign the treaty, you automatically, you know, are a member of the League of Nations. And most Americans, especially a lot of the congressmen during this time, were afraid this would actually be detrimental, that, you know, the U.S. would get pulled into more of these foreign conflicts. So we don't sign the Treaty of Versailles, okay? And the reason we don't is because Americans are kind of fearful that it will, by joining the League of Nations, it will pull us into more conflicts, okay? Any questions about World War One? The big things you want to know is, like, why we get involved in the war, know about the stuff on the home front that I mentioned, and then know about, obviously, Woodrow Wilson, the 14 points in the Treaty of Versailles, okay? You don't need to know any, you know, like, any battles, really, or anything for the First World War. Any questions about World War One? All right, so the U.S. actually makes out pretty good after World War One. A lot of Europe is really going to suffer from the First World War, but the U.S. will actually exit World War One more prosperous than ever. A lot of American businesses are going to make a lot of money off the war, making war materials, loaning money to countries that were involved in the war. So we, in the decade after World War One, which is referred to as the Roaring Twenties, the U.S. actually goes through this period of kind of unprecedented prosperity. We actually transition from being like a debtor nation, a nation that owes money to countries, to actually being a creditor nation, where we are the ones that have loaned out money and other nations owe us. And the 20s, what you want to know, the 1920s is kind of remembered as this period of prosperity, where Americans were making more money than ever, they had more free time than ever, and they're spending the money. So, you know, we actually come out of the World War pretty damn good. Like, our economy's booming. Americans are making more money than they ever have before. They are working less hours than they ever have before. And Americans are spending. So it really is a time of kind of economic growth and prosperity. And again, this period, this decade, is called the Roaring Twenties, okay? Some things about politics in the 1920s, you do want to know, the U.S. kind of retreats back into isolationism after World War One. Like I said, the Senate refused to sign the Treaty of Versailles because we don't want to be involved with the League of Nations. We don't want to get pulled into more wars. So basically, after the war, the U.S. really focused on kind of returning to what they call a return to normalcy, kind of returning back to focusing on domestic growth and prosperity, okay? There is actually, throughout the 20s, there's a string of Republican presidents that follow Woodrow Wilson, Warren G. Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. You do want to know, these Republican presidents will pursue pro-business policies. The economy is doing well in the 1920s. And basically what these Republican presidents do is they pursue a laissez-faire policy. They will keep government involvement in the economy to a minimum. They will also promote low taxes. They kind of move away from all these progressive reforms that we saw in the first part of the 1900s, where the government was really active and was taking a lot of oversight over businesses and stuff. The government will kind of retreat from that in the 1920s and kind of just let the economy do its thing, essentially. The economy is booming in the 1920s, and these Republican presidents will kind of just say, we'll sit back and just let it go. They're not going to, the government's not going to be very involved in the in this kind of prosperous economy during the 20s, okay? So you do want to know the 20s is a time of great sociocultural change. A lot of like, you know, a lot of kind of the aspects of modern America are really coming about during this period. Mass production is really booming during this period, and we get lots of new consumer products during this time, things like vacuum cleaners, washing machines, toasters, refrigerators, radios, cars. These things are being mass produced, and Americans are being encouraged to buy them. We see the development of a consumer culture in the 1920s, where basically Americans are kind of being constantly told they need to buy these luxury goods. And remember, this is kind of promoted through advertising. Advertising is a relatively new industry during this period. And remember, businesses will actually allow people to buy things on credit during the 20s. They can like put a down payment on a car or a vacuum cleaner and then make installment payments. So we get these credit plans where people can basically, just because you can't afford it up front doesn't mean you can't buy it. All you got to do is put a down payment on it and then make payments. So this, the 20s is very much a period of kind of consumption, mass production, and Americans are buying up all these new mass produced goods. Okay. There's also in literature, there's a group of American writers called the Lost Generation, like Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Sinclair Lewis, who actually will be pretty critical of America during the 20s. They kind of will criticize this consumerism of the upper class, the middle class, is kind of being empty and meaningless and distracting from things that really matter. We know about the Harlem Renaissance, very important. Remember, African Americans had moved north during World War I because, you know, part of the Great Migration. So we have these large concentrations of African Americans in northern cities, the best example being Harlem in New York. And basically the Harlem Renaissance is just a phrase that is kind of capturing the fact that African-American literature, painting, sculpture, dance, theater, music is all flourishing in these northern, in these African-American communities in these northern cities. Harlem was kind of seen as kind of the center of this. And for the first time, I would know African-American culture is really being kind of consumed and kind of embraced in mainstream American culture. We see the development of jazz music, which really becomes kind of like the genre of music of this generation. And this idea of the new Negro, you want to know what that is. It's this idea of like, this is kind of intertwined in the Harlem Renaissance, this idea that this new generation of African Americans are feel like they can express themselves. They take pride in their African American heritage and culture, and kind of for the first time are really able to express kind of the African-American experience through art, literature. They're going to strive for race, continue to strive for racial equality. So, you know about the Harlem Renaissance. Women are also pushing kind of cultural boundaries during this time. You know, women traditionally have been expected to stay at home, you know, the domestic sphere, have children, cook, clean, take care of the house, make husband happy. This younger generation of women in the 1920s is going to start to flout some of these traditions, kind of to shatter some of these kind of traditional expectations. Remember, the term for these younger women who are kind of pushing the boundaries is flappers. They wear shorter dresses, you know, like to their knees or higher, lower necklines. They wear bobbed hairstyles. They're out going to clubs, drinking, smoking, dancing. They're sexually liberated. They're having sex outside of marriage. All this stuff that would have been, again, kind of obviously very troubling to a lot of traditional-minded Americans. Like, this was not how a woman was supposed to behave. But women are kind of starting to challenge these kind of traditional roles and expectations that they've had. Important around the same time, obviously, kind of this goes hand in hand. Remember, 1920, the 19th Amendment is ratified, which gives women suffrage, the right to vote. So this is kind of a period of female liberation in a lot of senses, especially in cities. Now the countryside is still pretty conservative, but in cities, you know, this flapper culture is becoming pretty popular among women. Okay. Sports become big in the 1920s. You know, people have, like I said, they have more money and they work less, so they have more leisure time. So Americans are going to start embracing these kind of spectator sports, things like baseball, boxing. Some of the big sports stars like Babe Ruth, Jack Dempsey, the famous boxer. They're some of the big icons of the time period. Radio will obviously be another kind of means of allowing people to partake in sports. Speaking of, mass media takes off in the 1920s. What I mean by mass media is like these new forms of media that reach all over the country. Like no matter where you're at in the country, out west, the northeast, the south, you can partake in the same kind of media. Radio is going to be the most important form of media during this period. Everybody has a radio by the late 20s. Movies are also going to be really, really popular. At first, movies are silent, and then by 1929, we have talkies, movies with sound. And I would note, important to know, a very key point is that radio and movies really help kind of foster a common national culture in America, because you can be anywhere in the country and listen to the same music. You can listen to the same news programming, the same entertainment. You can watch the same movie stars, how they dress, what they drive. All this stuff is going to create kind of a common American culture and identity. Okay. Obviously Henry Ford is super important in this period. He doesn't invent the car, but he revolutionizes how it's made. He is an innovator in the sense that he adopts the assembly line in his automobile factories in Detroit. And this allows him to basically mass produce cars, which leads to the price dropping. And basically what you want to know about Henry Ford is he creates the first automobile for the people, the masses. And he does this by using the assembly line to mass produce them and make them cheaper. And this, of course, leads to like a car craze in America where everybody's buying cars. Aviation is another form of kind of transportation innovation in this time. People like Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart, who make the first solo flights across the Atlantic, they are kind of pioneering air travel, and they are some of the biggest celebrities of this time period, okay? So definitely know the 1920s is a period of economic kind of prosperity. You know, the U.S. really comes out of World War I doing really well. Our economy is booming. This is really when we become kind of the premier industrial economy in the world. Mass production is really coming like to maturity at this point. Americans are, you know, buying all these mass-produced luxury goods. So we have this culture of consumerism really kind of taking root. Things like advertising and these credit plans will encourage that. A lot of cultural changes, things like, you know, women African Americans are really kind of starting to challenge the status quo, things like the Harlem Renaissance and kind of the Flapper generation. Know about mass media for sure. Radio, movies are very important in shaping a common culture in America. And then obviously Ford and the Model T, which is the first kind of mass produced car, will change transportation. Okay. Questions about some of those big changes in the 20s. All right, so the 1920s is not all hunky-dory. There are some problems, and there is kind of some conflict in this decade. And a lot of it kind of stems from the fact that America's kind of developing into two different places. There is still like kind of the rural America, which is much more conservative, and then the urban America, like in the cities, which is much more modern and kind of more liberal. One of the ways we see this is in Prohibition. Remember, in 1919, right before the 1920s starts, the 18th Amendment was ratified. And remember, the 18th Amendment is the beginning of what we call Prohibition. It prohibited the manufacture, transportation, and sale of alcohol. Remember, Prohibition doesn't last long. It's largely a failure. But you do want to know, a lot of rural Americans who were conservative, they're Christian, they supported the ban. They supported the 18th Amendment because they thought alcohol was kind of a root of a lot of the social problems of the time period. On the other hand, you want to know, urban Americans who like to have a drink, and a lot of immigrants who are living in cities, a lot, you know, drinking is kind of a part of their culture. they will be opposed to prohibition. The federal government pretty quickly realizes, though, that prohibition is very expensive and it's very difficult to enforce effectively. Americans still want to drink, and they're going to find ways to do it, even if it's illegal. Remember, we'll have these kind of people will step in to fill the demand for illegal liquor. You get rum runners who are basically smuggling in liquor from the Bahamas and Canada. You get bootleggers who are just people that sell illegal alcohol, and they make a lot of money off of this. There are these secret bars called speakeasies where if you know the password, you can go in and get a drink. The big problem with prohibition, you want to know, though, is that crime actually skyrockets during prohibition, mainly because these organized crime groups will basically step in to meet this demand for illegal alcohol. They're going to control the bootlegging industry. So think most famous is Al Capone in Chicago. And these organized crime groups will make ridiculous amounts of money off the illegal kind of liquor trade. So the U.S. pretty quickly realizes that prohibition is kind of a failure. Like, Americans are kind of ignoring it. They're still drinking anyway. Crime is kind of on the rise because of, you know, the illegal, like the bootlegging industry. It's very expensive and hard to enforce effectively. So ultimately, in 1933, the U.S. will ratify the 21st Amendment. This is right when FDR is becoming president, actually. And really, all the 21st Amendment does is basically it overrides the 18th Amendment and makes alcohol legal again, ends prohibition. Okay, so prohibition is kind of like this failed experiment that ends up costing the government a lot of money, ends up again causing crime to skyrocket. It's basically ignored a lot, especially in cities. So the government kind of cuts its losses in 1933, and the 21st Amendment will override the 18th Amendment and make in the prohibition period, okay? You also want to know, in the 1920s, we see a resurgence in nativism. Remember, after World War I, there's this kind of, this Red Scare grips America, this fear that there could be a potential communist uprising. Remember, we saw in Russia in 1917, there was a communist revolution. At the same time that, you know, as World War I is going on, there are also a lot of labor unions and strikes taking place inside the U.S. There were some bombings on Wall Street, and some of the big industrialists of the time period, like J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller, they had bombs sent to their homes. So there was this kind of paranoia in the 20s that, you know, that essentially there could be a kind of communist uprising in America. And if you remember, most Americans tended to identify immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe as the kind of the ones who were bringing in these dangerous political ideas like socialism, communism, anarchism. Also, a lot of people did not like the fact that these new immigrants were Catholics and Jews, and they were kind of seen as a threat to like the American way of life. Rural Americans in particular were kind of scared of foreigners because they seemed very alien with their speaking different languages. They weren't Protestant, like I said. So you do want to know, nativism really spikes in the 20s. We see this in a couple things. The Sacco and Vanzetti trial, and there's two Italian immigrants, Sacco and Vanzetti, who were convicted of, or they were accused of murder. They were put on trial, and they eventually were found guilty, even though there was no like legitimate evidence to show they had done it. And most people attribute this guilty verdict to the fact that they were Italian immigrants who were anarchists. So like some of this kind of prejudice against immigrants and anarchism was the reason they were executed. We also get these, the government will engage in these things called the Palmer Raids, where they essentially will round up and deport immigrants who they feel like are dangerous. Like if they find out immigrants are communists or socialists, they could be basically deported. And really, most importantly, the government will respond to these fears of immigration by passing these strict quota laws, which will limit immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. Basically, the most famous of these laws is called the Emergency Quota Act of 1921. And again, a quota is just where the government is putting a limit on how many immigrants can come from certain places. And you do want to know, the Emergency Quota Acts, they were targeting Eastern and Southern Europe. So, like, you know, if you were from England or Ireland or somewhere, those countries were allowed to continue immigrating, having people immigrate in large numbers. But the U.S. is trying to kind of stem some of the immigration from these Eastern and Southern European countries that have these, you know, what a lot of Americans see is these undesirable immigrants who are bringing in, like I said, ideas of socialism, communism, anarchism. They're Catholic, they're Jewish. So also remember, the KKK has a revival during this period. The KKK is a nativist organization. Obviously, we know they go after African Americans, but they are also opposed to immigrants, in particular Catholics, Jews, socialists. So the KKK actually kind of makes a comeback during this period. All right, last little thing to talk about. Know about the Scopes trial. This is kind of another example of how rural America, conservative America, is kind of having a kind of battle with modern America. A lot of rural Americans, you know, are conservative. They're religious. They're fundamentalists, meaning basically they believe the Bible, the whole Bible, is the truth, and they will reject a lot of these urban values, which they see as kind of problematic, like flappers and these kind of modern women, immigration they're worried about. They're worried about drinking, so that's why they supported prohibition. If you remember 1925, there's a teacher in Tennessee named John Scopes who will teach evolution in science class, and he is arrested for violating a Tennessee law that basically said you couldn't teach evolution. And there's a big trial that's held for John Scopes, and this becomes kind of like a national trial. There's lots of media attention on this, and it becomes known as the Scopes monkey trial. The monkey part is a reference to the evolution stuff. But two high-profile attorneys, attorney Clarence Darrow will defend Scopes, and he will kind of make the case for science and modernity, you know, defending Scopes' right to teach evolution. And then the prosecutor was William Jennings Bryan, who was kind of representing the case for conservative America, rural values, Christianity. Ultimately, Scopes is found guilty. He gets like a little fine. But a lot of evolutionists will see this trial as a victory for them, because Clarence Darrow actually kind of gets William Jennings Bryan to admit that all the Bible is probably not literally true. So again, this is just kind of one of those events that shows this kind of showdown between traditional conservative ideas and these kind of new modern liberal ideas that are really growing in cities during this time. Okay. So a good way to think of the 20s is kind of like a tug of war between like conservative America, rural conservative America, and this kind of modern liberal urban America. Kind of these new values, like these changing roles of women, you know, they're going out drinking, dancing, listening to jazz music. A lot of conservative rural Americans kind of feel worried about this stuff. Okay. Any questions about any of this? All right. I think we'll just wait, and tomorrow we can do, we'll talk about the Great Depression, and we'll talk about the New Deal in World War II. I will see how much time. Tomorrow may be a little longer, or I may just kind of call it. You guys, I'll put the – I have that World War II cheat sheet that I gave you guys, has a good rundown of World War II. You know, you can review some. We'll go over that tomorrow. But, you know, I would try to be there if you can tomorrow. I'm also going to probably start tomorrow by really kind of talking about what you need to have ready for test day, because – we're almost there. So I would definitely encourage you to try to join the session tomorrow. You don't have to stay the whole time, but just come at least for the first part so that you're clear on what, you know, to expect on the test, how to make sure you're ready. If you have any questions about test day, you know, feel free to ask me anytime between now and Friday. And tomorrow I'll kind of go over everything one more time. Does anybody have any questions about the First World War, the Roaring Twenties? Did everybody, I know David, Nabil, Freya, Shiv, Joy, did y'all get your ticket? Should have been emailed to you today. If not, go ahead, Joy.
I did.
Good. Shiv, have you checked your email? You should have got your AP US.
Oh, yeah, I got my ticket. I just checked.
Do what?
I got my e-ticket.
You got it? Cool. Okay, so all y'all got it. That's good. I mean, just, you know, like what I would tell you guys is, none of you are going to handwrite. Is that right? Is anybody planning on handwriting theirs? If you are, definitely make sure you come to show up tomorrow, because I got to talk about, like, it. Honestly, unless you're just like a really slow typer, I would advise typing, because, like I said, writing is going to be a pain because you have to take pictures. There's a lot that could go wrong with it. And if something does go wrong, you know, you can retake the test. But I would probably avoid writing unless you just are really bad at typing and really slow, or you don't have a computer. But there's been some issues with uploading pictures. So you have to make sure, like, your picture is the right file type. I'll go over that tomorrow, but something to keep in mind. Have all of y'all done the test demo? If you haven't, you need to do that, because you need to, whatever you're going to use on Friday for the test, you need to have that and try to do the test demo with that. All the test demo does is gives you an idea like what it will look like. It also will let you like show you how you'll upload it. You need to go ahead and check all that stuff. So that's not like, is not new when Friday rolls around. Just to make sure that you understand how to upload everything, how it's going to look on the, you know, on test day, go do the demo. Okay. That's on the, I put that on the blog under that, the page about preparing for exam day. Or you can Google it. Just look up AP 2020 exam test demo. And, you know, do it on whatever device you're going to do it on Friday. Okay. Make sure, like I said, I would suggest maybe having one of those DBQ like outlines to help you kind of streamline your writing. Wouldn't be a bad idea. You can have notes. You can check Google if you want to. I would recommend probably not doing that because you have limited time. Mary, you can't talk to anyone. You cannot be on social media. That will be considered cheating. You'll get reported for that. Don't do that. So, yeah, that's what I would say. So, I'll go over more of this stuff tomorrow. Anybody have any questions real quick, though, about any of that? All right. Like I said, I would, you know, you got tonight, you got all tomorrow, you got Friday morning. The test is at 2:00 Eastern time, remember. If you're not on the East Coast time, make sure you you adjust. Make sure you get on 30 minutes before the test, so you can go ahead and put all your test code in, get all your information in, and be ready to go. All right. Yeah, I mean, we're down to it, guys. I mean, you know, you can study, keep studying content. I would go, period 7 has a lot of stuff. So, you know, I'm kind of rushing through some of this stuff. So I would encourage you to go look through the period 7 review stuff on the blog. Look, you know what you're strong at, you know what you're weak at. So go study the time period you need to review. I think I sent out like I'll try to find, there's a couple videos that have like really condensed kind of overviews of all the periods. I'll try to publish some of those and I'll let you know. Look, if you know the content and you understand the DBQ rubric and kind of how to get the points, that's about all you can do. And then, you know, do the best you can on exam day. Okay. Any questions about anything, ask me. I'm happy to help. Or if you want to stick around when everybody leaves and ask me a question, feel free. Or something comes up, just shoot me a message on Remind, email me. I'll be happy to answer any questions you got. All right. All right, guys, we're almost there. So, keep studying, keep grinding. I'll try, like I said, tomorrow, try to check in for the, for that session, that last session, because I'm going to go over some important stuff about exam day. And we'll try to do some last minute content review, and then it'll be Friday. So any questions? All right. Well, thanks for joining the Zoom, guys. And like I said, have a good afternoon. I'll see you guys tomorrow, hopefully.